Hello everybody, my name is Bezena Hinton and welcome to the session on salary-linked home finance presented by Anthony Asher. Anthony's going to give a short presentation for about 20 minutes, and after he's got through the main part of the presentation, then he'll welcome questions on the way through, but let him get through the main part first so he can explain the product. Then at the end of the session we'll have a whole range of discussion on this very interesting topic. I'm sure there'll be lots of questions. Please, when you give your questions, come up to the microphone in the middle and state your name, because all the sessions are being recorded. At this point I'd just like to welcome Anthony. I've just got his bio to read to you. To tell you a little bit about Anthony. He was in South Africa until 2002, and his longest lasting post was Professor of Actuarial Science at the University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg. He had also been Chief Actuary of the Prudential in South Africa and served on the boards of almost every kind of financial institution and a variety of government bodies. This may explain why he writes papers and government submissions in his attempts to link the technical details of actuarial work and the economic and ethical theory that he has picked up on the way with the bigger picture. In Australia, he has worked for APRA in policy and research and is now at Deloitte Actuaries and Consultants. He has particularly enjoyed engagements that link traditional actuarial work with strategic considerations and investment, legal and accounting technicalities. His family, including three almost post-teenage sons, live in Sydney, where he has managed to find regular time for bridge, bushwalking and fellowship. Please welcome Anthony Asher.
Thanks, Bezena, and thank you for venturing into a session that may never yield you any actuarial work at all. I've been working on this for, well, my first file note on mortgages, which was rather ill-informed, was dated January the 4th, 1981. By the time I got around to developing this idea 6 years later, I think I do know something about it. Well, I certainly have my opinions about it. As you will probably know, I can perhaps a little bit overly opinionated. But this is my best idea ever. Okay, this is the way of significantly reducing risk both for younger people entering the housing market and older people wanting a smooth retirement income. So what I'm going to talk about is, and I'd like you please to listen for that part, and then ask questions once I've at least explained what it is, because it is different, let me warn you that. Just explain a little bit about the motivation for its development, the advantages and risks for the homeowners and for the investors, the likely returns, and then the issues in implementation. I call it salary-linked home finance and not salary-linked mortgages, because it is not legally it probably should not be called a mortgage, and it doesn't rely on interest rates. Okay, that's the first clue. It doesn't rely on interest rates. I'll say that three or four times, and then probably in response to one or two questions, say it again. Superannuation, so the idea is you take money from the superannuation or a pension fund, put it into a pooling vehicle, and advance it to the homeowner. Interest rates do not affect repayments or the term, and the investment return is equal to the rate of growth in salaries of the underlying pool with some slight twiddles. So the formulae, when we start our contract, I will lend you the money. I'll lend it to Bezena, who's quite young here, and I'll lend her the money. And the amount I lend, I will then divide by the term, so 20 years, let's say. And if she's earning, you know, let's imagine she's very young, so she's only earning $100,000 a year. I can lend her up to 4 years the annual salary. This is an example. 4 years divided by 20 times $100,000 gives me 20%. So she will contract to pay me 20% of her income for 20 years. And that will extinguish the debt. She has no salary increases. I will get my capital back. But I will also, if she gets the salary increases, I take 20% of her salary increases. And because she's such a good bet, I'll make a lot of money. Okay, so if she wants to repay early, the amount that she's got to repay is then the remaining term times her income at the time, times the percent she's contracted for. So if she's paid 5 years repayments, Income has now risen to 134,000. 15 times 134,000 times 20% gives you 402,000. In other words, the amount outstanding can actually go up before it comes down, but it must eventually come down because that term goes to zero. So what you end up with, if this graph, and I've constructed the graph to show that in some instances it can go up, and here it goes up marginally. If inflation rises significantly, it can actually rise quite significantly. But this blue line shows the blue line shows a salary-linked home finance. This yellow line is what a conventional mortgage would be. So you start off, and this is sort of as real life as I can get, the idea would you would actually start off with more. It would go up and then eventually come down. You end up with more finance. And the interesting and useful thing, and it doesn't come out very well on this the way this slide is presented here, but basically the initial installments on the salary-linked home finance will start below the conventional mortgages. So you actually get more money for less initially, but clearly you pay more later. This light blue line going up to the to the top there. So at this point, I'll go on to the consequences later, but has anyone got some questions about the actual product? So far so good. Alex?
What if the person dies or becomes incapacitated?
All right, the amount outstanding that they would have to repay is then calculated with that second formula. The incapacity, it would be... The income there would be based on the income at the last income they earned. So if they were to become unemployed, they would have to repay the amount of their last income. There would be other ways of doing it, but that's this product as designed.
Maternity and paternity leave
would have to be negotiated, either based on the and one of the things I think you can do for short periods of unemployment or leave. Is instead of saying, well, that your 20 years or 240 months of repayments don't necessarily have to be consecutive, you could actually take a little bit of a break.
So you voluntarily chose to take a reduction in income?
One of the things one would have to do to avoid moral hazard is actually put a floor in, so there would be no reduction or some limited... if you voluntarily took a lower salary... your percentage would go up so that the installments remain the same.
The definition of income, are you talking about a total package concept?
The one that would seem to work best would be something like taxable income, so that you could use the tax certificate to make sure that people are reporting it all, so that you're at least on the same side as the tax office. So it would be package. It would be the taxable proportion of your package. That would have to be adjusted in terms of, yeah. One of the things I'll say is that clearly this is, because of these moral hazard and anti-selection risks, you would probably want to limit it to the employees of large employers. Yeah, that's sort of the package story. Okay, why did I get round to this? And it may be helpful in sort of, well... In fact, I wrote the paper, and my referee was Christopher Joy at Bismarck, who I should be sort of thanked, actually, in the paper, because he produced some really useful suggestions. One was that I put a motivation at the front. Basically, the motivation initially was, and in South Africa in the early 80s, with interest rates of 18 or 19% and inflation at 14%, you had this massive inflation tilt. How do you get around that? Well, obviously, you need to start lower and move up. The trouble is... If you do that, if your salaries don't keep up with the increase in the inflationary, the increase in the instalments, you end up in a situation where the those with poorer salary increases end up not with a balloon payment that they can never repay. And that has been the experience with a number of what can be called dual index mortgages, where people have borrowed borrowed on this basis. Salaries don't keep up with inflation in particularly inflationary environments, and you end up with the sort of the rump of 20% of the loans just cannot be repaid. So what the advantage of this, the salary-linked design, is that you have this automatic cross-subsidy in the investment pool between those who are lucky and get big increases and those who are unlucky and get smaller increases, and there's no actual credit loss if people don't, because everyone can repay it. The second thing was that There's been a long-standing ban on usury in most, well, certainly Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. Why interest rates are banned in some of, have been banned in some of these societies, and the question is, why should that be the case? And it would appear the case is really that interest rates in many at many times fall very heavily on the unlucky, as I've just illustrated with these dual index mortgages. So there has been a tendency to legislate against them from time to time. And in fact, there have been successful, partly inspired, but alternatives to fixed interest rates, using interest rates for loans. Such arrangements as, I don't know if you've come across it, but farming on the halves, a sort of sharecropping, we called it in South Africa, whereby the landlord got 50% of the crop and the farmer got 50%. Works fairly well, very robust, and shares the risk quite well between the provider of capital and the user of the capital. And finally, the objective to provide a smooth inflation-protected returns for pensioners. Pensioners need inflation protection, and I don't think they. I think, well, certainly the last year has shown they can't really deal with equity market risks. So, just a quick. That's inflation in the USA over the last 100 years, going back to 1913. And I want to make the point that there are three periods.
1, 2, 3.
Where pensions would have lost half their value in the space of 10, 15 years. I do not believe that we've broken the back of inflation. I think it remains a very significant risk. And I would be extreme. In fact, at this point, I would think the balance of probability is we're going into another phase of hyperinflation caused by reinflationary financial, these reinflation packages and possibly peak oil. Right, but that's a curfew. Let's get on with that. Advantages is for the homeowner. You get more money now, no interest rate risk, simple to understand, easy to budget. All I've got to do is 20%, easy. The risks, you've got unemployment risks, same as you currently have, except you probably have a bigger house, so you'll lose more. And if you put money into it, you'll lose more. The salary reductions are an issue over time particularly, but you can renegotiate terms. You're more likely to get negative equity because you've borrowed more and it goes up before it comes down, but you can transfer that to a new house, and you will pay more in future. And this, I think, is probably the biggest risk, is that people will borrow and then they will say, we didn't understand we would pay more later. So my view is that you actually video the responses. You ask people, what are the advantages and disadvantages of this product, and you let them tell you, and you keep that on video so that when they complain to the newspaper in 10 years' time, you pull out the video and show that they really did understand. And we did some work, almost got off the ground in South Africa. When we did the market research for that, I found that people with probably less than 5 or 6 years of education actually understood this product much better than the conventional mortgage, because they understood a fixed proportion of their salary. And when you asked them what's the disadvantage, they said, well, you'll pay more later. They knew it was very easy to understand. The different people that didn't understand, of course, were the officials in the building society that I was trying to get involved in, because they couldn't get out of their heads that interest rate was not involved. It's quite an interesting. I've gone up. There's just a table of what I've shown you earlier. You get more money now, based on what I would think current loadings would be to make this product viable. Probably about 8% more. You could borrow, and your initial installments could be as much as 27% less. Nice deal. For the super investors, you get, basically, it seems to me that the return that you want in a superannuation fund is actually inflation plus something for productivity. Wage inflation is actually the benchmark for a pension investor. This graph here shows the CPI. Black line is wages, the dotted line is CPI plus 1% per annum. So wages have beaten inflation by about 1% per annum since 1967 in Australia. And that's quite common worldwide, that sort of margin. So the yield is attractive. You get inflation plus the productivity growth, effectively wage growth. And the magic is, of course, you get promotions because you lend to actual real people, not to the average. And the real people are creeping up the wage curve and getting promotions. Promotions, difficult to tell. I'll come on to that just in the next slide. Very low risk of missing the benchmark because you've got all the advantages that you should have when you lend retail lending. Doesn't stop subprime mistakes, but should reduce them. What returns do you get? Well, we have some idea. Actuaries of defined benefit funds have some idea of what promotions are like over the lifetime. National statistics give us some idea. The problem there is that it's very often the average, and they're cross-sectional, not panel or cohort studies. This is a cohort study from Canada, which shows it very nicely. Again, I'm afraid the graph doesn't come out well on this screen, but basically you've got segments there of earnings. So this is there are 20 cohorts on that 10 cohorts on that graph, and they're just showing that salaries basically for people with higher education rise very dramatically until about 40, and then tend to rise much slower later on. They don't actually come down, which the cross-sectional graphs show. They continue to rise because the people with the highest incomes tend to retire early. So there's a sort of distortion there. But I still wouldn't be particularly keen to lend to people at higher ages. Because the whole advantage here is you get those promotional increases you want people to work for. Comparative returns, this is just Australia, and the volatile line is share market returns by year. The purple is housing interest rates, and then I've assumed wages growth plus 3% to allow for promotions. That's the brown line. Shows that certainly in the 70s, great to be in wages. We're going to that sort of environment again. It'd be a good time to be in wages. Wasn't good in the 80s when interest rates were raised to bring inflation down, but it's more or less a reasonable return at this point. Issues relating to anti-selection and moral hazard, very definitely significant. It's less attractive. Okay, from an anti-selection point of view, clearly if people have the opportunity to think, and many of them are so governed by liquidity issues they won't, but if they have the opportunity to think, it's less attractive to people who with high inflation expecting big promotions. So what you need is some sort of model to distinguish ex-ante salary growth expectations and adjust loading. So the basic model says you pay 20%, but because Bazin is such a good risk, I'll actually give her 18% because I expect the big increases to come through. Similarly, someone who is already, say, 35 and in a rather low expectation of growth, a nurse not expecting promotion, for instance, you would perhaps make it 22% instead so that you expected a reasonable return. Can be adjusted for that. Managing moral hazard. Okay, now I'm taking 20% plus the 20% that the government is taking means 40% or 50% or 60% that you're paying now in tax. You're only entitled to 40% of your income. Is it worth working? Lots of research on this. The impact on males, it looks as though the income effect more than deals with the substitution effect. So although you end up with less income when you work, because most men actually have target, they actually work harder when you take away some of their money on tax. Well, they're as likely to work harder as they will to work less because now their leisure is cheaper. I saw a study yesterday, a meta-study yesterday, Saturday I looked at where they reckon the average elasticity was 10% for men. For women it's a bit higher, but it has been dropping as women enter the workforce on more equal terms with men. They tend to be much the same. It does have an impact, but not great. But in any event, in order to manage the moral hazard and the possibility of a drop, you're going to put some sort of floor and ceiling to the rate of increase. My current feeling is that the floors would be of the order of 5% less than inflation and the ceiling about 15% more than inflation. You would have access to the ATO tax certificates. So they also credit reputational risks, operational risks in introducing new systems. Christopher suggested the need for government involvement. He said, you'll never collect this money unless the government helps you. I don't think that's right. I think he made the comparison between HECS and loans for higher education. Obviously, it seems to me that it's very difficult to follow students once they've graduated, and maybe you do need the government to chase them. There'll be no difficulty in finding these people. They're in the house. So I don't think it'll be particularly difficult in terms of... Well, they should be in the house, though. So, okay, I had this idea, published it at the International Congress of Actuaries in 1991. Why hasn't it been introduced? Well, I don't know. Clearly, a deficiency in my personality and ability to get things done. I am very much comforted by the fact that inflation-linked bonds also took many years to get involved. Shared equity mortgages took a long time to get introduced. And in fact, human capital contracts, which were suggested by Milton Friedman in 1945, actually weren't introduced, and they're very similar to this, but for financing tertiary education. 60 years for a Nobel Prize winner, so I've still got another 30 years before I'm behind. Joseph Stiglitz, who won the Nobel Prize for Economics in 1981 and worked for the Clinton administration, for the 1991, I think, worked for the Clinton administration and helped with the introduction of TIPS, which is Treasury Inflation Protected Securities, the U.S. American Inflation Protected Assets. He wrote an article in the journal JPE Economics, Terry? JEP, Journal of Economic Perspectives. He said there were three difficulties, and he said it was really surprised to him to work out why there was so much opposition to TIP, into the introduction of TIPS from within the Treasury, from within the government in the US. And he said that he identifies three reasons, because he said that they were obviously a Pareto improvement. They improved. No one was worse off as a consequence of the introduction of these products. Similarly here, no one would be worse off for the introduction of these products. There may be some risks, but he said there were three reasons why TIPS took a decade to introduce. In fact, much longer, 30 years from the time they were suggested. He says, some people never understood the government's tax receipts also went up with inflation, and thus index bonds actually reduced the government's real risk. So I think index bonds have lowered the government's risk. Salary-linked home finance will reduce the risks that pensioners face. It will protect them against inflation, and it reduces the risk that homeowners face because they actually have the income to fund the increasing installments. Now, some people don't understand that, he said, and that has been my feeling, that there hasn't been that understanding, that in fact inflation adjustments are the right way of reducing risks. They don't increase risk, they reduce risks. He says some misguided inflation hawks thought that indexing would reduce the resolve of government to fight inflation. Very common in South Africa. This was initially opposed on the basis that it would, by indexing cash flows to inflation, it looked as though you were giving up the fight against it. May be true, it's just the fight that inflation generally falls very heavily on people who don't have inflation-linked cash flows, like pensioners, and they don't very often have much of an impact on voting, much power. And then the final, almost clinching one, the experience in England, this is quoting Stiglitz, the experience in England from the perspective of bond traders was that these bonds were a failure. People bought them for their retirement and did not trade them. They put them in the bottom drawer. And left them. And as he goes on to say, which I didn't have space to quote here, I thought that was the purpose of investment. Put them in the bottom drawer and let them pay out their return, not trading them. So this is a problem. There certainly will be less trading. So that's my story, I think. So the question is, you can ask any questions, but for discussion, would you want one if you were 26 and needed finance? Or if you were 66 and needed security for your inflation-protected income stream, then the question, what would be a fair expected return in comparison with existing mortgages and in comparison with alternative assets? Because here you've got a situation, this is a new type of instrument, the price will determine the balance between investors and borrowers. So at what price do you think that's going to settle if one was to be able to set up a market in this approach? What sort of return would an investor require at a level that a borrower, home finance recipient would be prepared to accept? And are there any insurmountable risks, anti-selection or moral hazards, operational and credit risks? And the big question, I've met a number of people in Australia who are prepared to put this product on the market if they could find some superannuation fund to invest on it. We're looking for $300 million only. Who's going to be first to invest?
Thank you very much. Is that working?
This one works? Oh, that's better. Okay.
Thanks very much, Anthony. That's been very interesting. And I'd like to invite questions from the floor. Has anyone got anything they'd like to address? Yeah. Could you just stand up and speak into the mic because the sessions are recorded? Is that okay?
Thanks very much, Anthony. That's wonderful. I'm a bit nervous about the anti-selection effects and the influence on individuals. Would it corrupt your idea too much to try and make it semi-indexed, so that it could be done on OOT, or if it was to teachers, that we were using a teacher's index of salaries, so that there wasn't any option really to gameplay the thing, but you would actually still be able to borrow more, and the investor on the other end would be knowing that they were actually getting a return, which would be ideal if you'd got, say, a teacher's pension fund, to now know that you've actually got some income which is actually related to teacher's salaries.
I mean, Andrew, the dual index mortgage was pushed very hard by the World Bank in the early 90s when I was first looking at this, and they were indexed to national inflations rather than industrial ones. So maybe teachers would work. But I do think if you look at the actual, if you do the modelling of the difference between the best and the worst paid teachers, there is a fairly significant difference. So I do think you put quite a burden on those that get lower increases if you don't tailor it to their particular salary increases. So the question is anti-selection going to be a problem? Now, I think anti-selection is not a problem if you can identify where people are going. And I think because most of these folk will already have had enough, because the credit management is going to be such that you're going to have had 3 or 4 years of work experience before you've saved enough to put a deposit down for these houses, you have some experience, and based on that, the last three or four years of salary increase you've got, you will have a fair idea of what salary increases will be in the future. The real issue is people then going to work less hard because of the moral hazard, and I just don't think that's true. People don't. They've got so much more life. There's so much more to life than trying to play the game of cutting off your nose to spite your face, because that's what you're doing. Because that graph of increases, you get the benefit of salary increases now for the rest of your life. I mean, what you don't show is, in fact, what I haven't shown is that the graph of women's salary increases, where the impact of having children has a massive impact later, because you never get back onto the ladder as to where you were. So single women's salary increases look much the same as men's. Married women are quite different for that reason. So I really think I'm not particularly worried about anti-selection and moral hazard, but clearly investors may be.
Yep.
Jeff Austin. I thought it was interesting. There's a couple of things that are running around in my head, so I don't know where to start, but I'll start here. In the anti-selection issue, I hear your comments, but there's a lot of self-employed people. There's a lot of people that don't have a salary. There's a lot of people that manage their taxable income over and above a core salary. Mm. So, you know, one of the ways to reduce your repayment is to take some negative gearing on another property, mm-hmm. finance conventionally, reduce your taxable income, reduce your repayment on this type of property. So it just seems to me that there's a whole range of complexities here that really come down to individual circumstances, particularly when you think about self-employed people. And I used to run a number of the retail product lines at CBA, including the home finance business and mortgage business. And so we did spend a little bit of time thinking about, you know, business extension and the fact that CBA had so many businesses and the notion of, you know, retirees' needs and, you know, not a lot of time, but, you know, one of the tests that always ran around in my mind is, could you explain this to your mother in one conversation? And you made the point that it's actually easier than a normal mortgage. And it's a different dimension.
Mm.
But I'm still trying to work out how I could explain this to my mother in one conversation. And with the notion of somebody being self-employed at the same time, I don't know whether I could.
Look, I think I don't think self-employed are a target for this. I think the target, as I say, is people who are employed by large employers. So I think in the first instance, the major target initially would be teachers, nurses, policemen, make up a few hundred thousand, you know, a very large proportion of the employed market. Perhaps employees of the banks and other large institutions where you can be very sure, where the salary is not something that they are in accustomed to manipulate, and in fact you've got the employer there who's also got an interest in, hopefully an interest in, from the super side, in maintaining a level of integrity.
Having said that, our workforce has become much more flexible.
Indeed, yeah. Well, also more employed by government.
Thank you. Yep.
Richard.
Richard Starkey from Mercer. Thanks for your presentation. Just thinking, I didn't quite get whether you mentioned a pooling vehicle, but are you talking about linking up, you know, one retiree with one individual needing money?
No.
But I guess what we've got then is you've got fixed term mortgages, but what retirees are after is lifetime income. And I'm just wondering if you thought much about the how to marry up those or how to pool that so that you're meeting both needs.
It clearly, the lack of liquidity is a problem. I mean, I was clearly envisaging a situation where you would have, you know, hopefully 10,000 employees in a pool and the investor would be investing in that pool. The cash flows initially would not be quite strong enough to fund an annuity, but they would be reasonable. We spent a lot of time in the early 90s when we were trying to design the product, looking for a way of developing, of matching cash in and cash out. And I think there is, because the cash flows come quite quickly, you actually can get a reasonable level of matching, but clearly you cannot guarantee for a pensioner that they will always have borrowers out there to prepare to take the money. So assuming that the rates of a churn are half that they would be under conventional mortgages, because the advantage is you don't have to churn here because you're locked in. The idea is it's a long-term instrument both for borrower and investor. I think there'll probably be enough cash, almost certainly be enough cash to pay off the annuities. What there probably won't be is the ability to guarantee that you'll always get this inflation-listed return. It's going to be approximate.
Yep, Phil?
Phil Stott. I'm interested, Anthony, in what the volatility in the rate of return is for the investor. I mean, it's clear if you think about the math that if there's no inflation, obviously the rate of return is zero. Equally, if there's a constant rate of inflation, then the return is equal to that constant rate. But it's not at all clear to me what happens where you have periods of, you know, over a 20-year period where you might have periods of hyperinflation followed by low inflation or whatever. I mean, does it just turn out to be an average return over, you know, like a weighted average of the inflation rate over the period, or how does it work out?
Yeah, good question. Depends on actually on the precise nature of the repayments, and obviously on the extent to which the wages and salaries follow inflation. What happens, until you get hyperinflation, wages and salaries may well lag inflation by six months or more. Once you get to hyperinflation, they start following pretty much identically. And under those circumstances, to the extent that you can keep the actual amount outstanding based on the most current wage, it'll follow the wages exactly. To the extent that there are lags, and some of the designs that I'm intending it to lag a little bit, there will be some lag as to the impact. But I, if you do put in any lags, you then have to put in a provision for hyperinflationary times, which I would do under these circumstances. Looking 20 years ahead, I would put some adjustment for hyperinflation in, which is an interesting point. I mean, how many of us have got adjustments, potential adjustments for hyperinflation on our existing products? Sorry.
Okay.
Yeah. You said that teachers' associations and policemen and such would be your target market for this. That's a really interesting idea, but I was wondering if you've done any work to see, like, if there is a level of interest for this product.
Sorry, your name is?
It's Tony Byrne.
Thanks, Tony. I haven't in Australia. South Africa, when we did it, we had a number of markets, you know, these focus groups, and there was massive demand, massive interest. I must say that the actual cash flow improvement was quite significantly bigger than it was what was here. Anecdotally, I mean, I've often spoken about it to people, and I think I perhaps once have come across someone in probably 100 different discussions in their 20s who doesn't have a higher rate of implicit discount to their future salary than their expectation of salary increases, if you can work that one out. I mean, most people want the money now. And if you've got a screaming kid in the bedroom with you, you want the money now.
Anyone else got a question?
Just a follow-up. Does that level maintain itself after you explain that, you know, you're going to wind up paying more in the end?
It does, and, well, I mean, you know, yes, it does. I mean, they still are interested in that because in terms of affordability, you know it's affordable. I mean, that's the beauty of this product. And I don't think people, very often actuaries who haven't had that experience so much because their salaries ran away from their installments very much quicker than for the average person out there. When you look at the, just look at mortgage stress. I mean, 10% of borrowers are paying 35% of their income on mortgages. I mean, it's massive out there. So, you know, fairly small levels of, and this is 20% reduction in your cash flow now, it's heaven. I think there'll be massive demand on that score, and anti-selection will fall out the window. I mean, the money now is the thing.
Anthony, I was just wondering if you could tell us a bit about why the product didn't take off in South Africa.
We were within a month of launching in the early 90s. But what happened was, 1989, for the first time, the white government allowed blacks to own leasehold property in urban areas. Interest rates were 12%, and 300,000 or 400,000 homes were built in the space of 12 months. Interest rates then rose from 12 to 20%, or 18%. So installments went from 30% of income to 45% of income in the space of 12 months, 14 months. At the same time, Nelson Mandela was released, and there was massive amounts of political movement. By 1992, when we wanted to launch, there were over 300,000 houses in possession of the banks. And the banks were not able to take possession. They were in possession, but they weren't able to take possession because when they went in, they got it was political, though. Tire on the roof and it was burnt down. So under those circumstances, this product would have put a million families could have enabled a million families to move into housing. But under those circumstances, no bank was going to move into that low-income housing market because they had no indication at all they would get any money back. So basically, political changes. Mm-hmm. The 90s killed it, and then by that stage I was too involved in other things to get back again. So,
yes, very disheartening for you.
What?
Bill Dwyer from non-government school Super. We'd be interested in this, obviously, for our pensioners. But in terms of people taking up the product, what do you think the influence of the low level of current interest rates would be on the demand for this sort of product at the moment?
But I was hoping you would tell me how much I'd have to pay on these things. And look, it's difficult. I mean, really difficult. I think as a pensioner, the first thing question you ask yourself is, can I live on my investment income? And when shares are yielding you possibly as much as 8% gross, it's very difficult to argue that you should be trying for inflation plus 3%. So I think the loadings would have to be quite significant in the current market. Should, however, under normal circumstances, when share prices move to a more reasonable level, and even under the existing circumstances, the need for diversification, I think it's quite difficult to argue that if this product could yield you, could have an expected yield of inflation plus 4 or 5, at that point it becomes an attractive diversification, perhaps 5% of your assets. As I say, you tell me. But because it has no correlation with existing assets, it really must be attractive at a low level. And that's all at this point. Initially, one just wants to try it out, see what happens. It would have to be, the loadings would have to be such that both the borrowers and the investors were happy with the return. There must be some level where they're happy, but markets are rather distorted at the moment, so, yeah.
Yep. Hi, Hayden Burno. I'm thinking, if I was a borrower and I'm about to get a 10-20% pay rise, I would want to refinance maybe to a traditional product or maybe get a margin loan for a week and then refinance at my higher salary. How would you prevent that?
The intention for one of the ways of doing it is just putting the ceiling on. So if you take inflation plus 15, so if a really big increase, you would be protected against paying too much anyway. For the smaller increases, at sort of 10%, I would envisage putting in a fairly significant repayment penalty in the early years, so that there's not this movement in and out.
We might just have time for one final question. Does anyone? Yep.
Robert Schwerkold. I'm trying to think of a parallel with the health insurance industry, where you've got community rating and. Are they related or not? Is it going to give longer term issues? Does this need a big pool of
borrowers? And
borrowers, yeah.
I think the answer is really whether the extent to which you're prepared to accept volatility. Clearly, the smaller pools will be more volatile, and I can't answer the extent to which. Salary increases differ between individuals. I haven't done that analysis, but I don't think it's not dramatic. I don't think it's, I think your route in will come in at a couple of hundred borrowers would probably be okay.
At that point, I think we're going to have to call the discussion to a close. I'd just like to really thank Anthony for a very interesting and thought-provoking paper, and I hope that he has some success with it in the next 30 years and sooner rather than later. And on behalf of the Institute, I'd just like to present him with this bottle. Thank you.